Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Ah, put me down, you Brobdingnagian blunderbuss!
He's a little cranky from teething.
Are babies born with a sense of right and wrong?
Well, if they are, they lose it pretty quickly. Otherwise, parents wouldn't have to work so hard to make sure that Jimmy doesn't grow up to be a jerk.
And my wife, poor lady, was... I'm just sorry what the children have done to her, man.
Don't you need to have a sophisticated cognitive system in order to have a sense of morality?
I remember turning from 1 year old to 2 years old. I was real upset because I figured in 1 year my age doubled.
Is morality innate, learned, or does it come from some combination of nature and nurture?
I mean, look at any newspaper. Aliens are getting autopsies and devil babies are being born every day.
Our guest is Paul Bloom, author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil.
Babies and the Birth of Morality, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University. That's where Ken and I hang around the philosophy department.
Today we're asking about babies and the birth of morality.
One of the many questions on this subject is whether morality is innate or learned, nature or nurture. If we want to answer that question, what better place to begin than with babies?
But John, do you really think that newborns, of all people, have something to actually teach us about the nature of morality?
Well, why so skeptical, big guy?
Well, it's not like newborns face a lot of deep moral dilemmas. Should I laugh at the big guy making the silly faces at me? Or should I cry? That's about it.
You underestimate them, Ken. I mean, babies may not be fully developed moral agents, but studying them, even when they're just a few months old, can actually teach us a lot about the nature of morality.
I don't see how babies are born totally self-centered, all in, no superego. Sure, other people matter to them as tools, as sources of food, clean diapers, and comfort, but they don't know anything about right and wrong. Have you been around babies? Not until we start to teach them, anyway.
Well, I'm not trying to deny that becoming a fully developed moral agent takes time. Education, socialization.
Which is exactly my point.
Yeah, but my point, if you'd let me finish, is that adult morality actually builds on and reflects the basic moral instincts that are there right from the start.
Oh, the basic moral instincts of babies. Now, those would be what exactly?
Well, a tendency to help others in need, sympathy for the pain and suffering of others. Even a tendency to punish those who do wrong and reward those who do right.
Yeah, once we teach them by punishing them and rewarding them a little bit.
No, you're wrong about that. It happens naturally without much adult intervention from very early ages and in every culture.
Yeah, right, John. One-year-old babies enforcing universal standards of infant morality, that'll be the day.
You scoff, but consider this little experiment with one-year-olds. You got some puppets, three puppets. Call it roll the ball, the game they play. One puppet rolls the ball to another puppet who rolls it back. Sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe for a one-year-old.
Okay, so imagine the puppet in the middle rolls the ball to the puppet on the right who rolls it back. And then the puppet in the middle rolls the ball to the puppet on the left. And that one doesn't roll it back, but gets up and walks away with the ball.
Oh, bad, bad puppet.
See, now you're thinking just like a one-year-old. A child will punish the puppet for its naughtiness. If you put a treat in front of each of the puppets and invite the kid to take one of the treats away, guess which puppet they'll take it from?
Don't tell me. The naughty one.
Some kids have even been known to slap the naughty puppet.
John, I'm sorry, but I think you're projecting adult concepts onto babies. Maybe the kid just doesn't like the naughty puppet. Maybe they're upset because the mean little puppet ended the fun game. That doesn't show that kids are explicitly thinking in terms of adult moral concepts like fairness or justice, especially.
Well, I grant you that pre-verbal children can't give explicit moral arguments and presumably can't think them either. They can't base things on explicit moral principles the way adults sometimes do. There's less of a gap, however, between infants and adults on all this than you imagine.
Yeah, I don't even see why we should call these instincts that kids show moral. Why should we call them moral instincts?
Well, why in the world not?
Because, John, it's one thing to be blindly driven by hardwired instincts of the sort you're saying kids have. It's an entirely different thing to make conscious choices based on your understanding of moral principles and concepts and what you owe to other people. That's what morality is all about.
Oh, Ken, you're channeling your inner Kant again. You need to try to find your inner Hume. Moral instincts, sympathy, that's what comes first, not moral principles. The inborn moral instincts of children are the building blocks on which all the highfalutin moral theories of anal German philosophers rest.
Oh, John, you're making out kids out to be moral paragons. Look. Why is the world, the adult world, such a moral mess if the foundations of morality are built right into the genes like you're suggesting?
Well, I'm not saying kids are moral saints. I mean, babies are naturally altruistic and caring, but only up to a point. Just like grown-ups, they easily form in-groups and out-groups. They can be quite nasty to the out-groups. So the moral messiness, like the moral positiveness, is there from the very beginning.
Yeah, you know, I gotta say, I'm not totally convinced, but I am willing to admit that there's an awful lot to think about here.
And to give us more food for thought, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, out to discover exactly how researchers probe the moral lives of people who can't even talk yet. She files this report.
How come infants, when early in the second year for sure, start just handing back out of reach objects to people?
Auden Dahl is a psychology professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He studies babies to try and find out why we do things like help or hurt other people.
It's about how did humans come to develop a civilization? How is it that kids can coexist in a preschool, in a classroom, and be friends? Right? These are the questions we're ultimately trying to answer.
Studying anyone in the lab is a relatively recent practice. The first formal psychological studies started in the late 1800s. Looking at babies and their moral development is even more recent. It began around the early 2000s. So Dahl is cautious about reading too much into the results just yet.
It's very, very hard, I think, to study kids' motivation. I don't think we have developed very, very good methods for that.
One of Dahl's studies looks at when kids pitch in to help someone who's having trouble, reaching something they dropped on the floor, for example. He and his fellow researchers videotape the scenarios and code the baby's behavior. Did the kid voluntarily make an effort to help? Did she help after being encouraged to? Did she watch the person needing help for a while before deciding to pitch in? Or was the baby totally oblivious to what was happening?
I don't think helping behavior is necessarily motivated early in life from a desire to promote the well-being of somebody else. And that's why I would be hesitant to call it an altruistic behavior.
Dahl's research suggests that sometimes it's just about wanting to be involved with other people.
So you think that, when kids start helping, they start harming. But they don't, right? That's not what's happening. You don't see a sharp decline in harming behaviors at the same time as you see a sharp increase in helping behavior.
So drawing conclusions is hard to do, and it's complicated by the logistics of studying babies.
Part of the reality of doing research with infants is that they sometimes don't feel like doing what we wish they would do.
And this one here is a vocabulary list. So essentially here...
Over at Mills College in Oakland, Priya Shimpy runs a language development lab that also studies babies and toddlers.
If a child cries, if a child does not want to participate, that's part of, you know, a child's typical behavior repertoire. And if a child decides at that moment, you know, this is not working for me, we don't push the issue.
At the lab, they've developed a routine to warm up the child first. A 3-year-old named Ruby is playing a shapes game with the researchers before an experiment. Shimpy says without that warm-up time, it would be hard to get good data.
They just might be more apprehensive or might not be as comfortable, and we might not get from them the kind of natural behaviors that we're really looking for in our studies.
And getting the parents on board helps too. During the experiment, Ruby sits on her mom's lap and the assistants explain what's about to happen.
So I'm going to turn off the lights while we show her the video clip. We just ask that you keep your eyes closed and try not to speak with her just because we don't want you to be influencing her reactions in any subtle way.
Okay.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and turn off the lights.
If kids seem to make choices with negative connotations, like not helping or siding with someone who shows antisocial behavior, researchers assure the parents it's perfectly normal.
There are a lot of reasons why a child might not help in a given situation.
Again, Auden Dahl from UC Santa Cruz.
Could be that they're a little nervous because this is a weird new situation. It could be that they're just interested in something else. That's not a sign of a psychopathology.
Dahl says kids might like one thing more than another, but that doesn't mean they think one's bad. And it's not really a question of morals. It's about preferences. And he says most of the time, both parents and kids enjoy the experience in the lab. After all, it's not every day that we have the opportunity to help future generations figure out how to get along with each other. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Thanks, Natalie. Out of the mouths of babes, or babies at any rate, comes great insights. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about babies and the birth of morality. We're joined now by Paul Bloom. He's a professor of psychology and cognitive science from Yale University. He's author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Paul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Paul, I can see why somebody might find babies fascinating. And I can see why somebody might find morality fascinating. But you find them both fascinating. What's so fascinating about the combination of the two?
It's a sort of peanut butter and chocolate thing. They're each extraordinarily interesting by themselves, and together they're this great combination. I've always been interested in morality, and my interest in babies came from two sources, both family-related. One is my wife, Karen Wynn, runs a baby lab at Yale, and all my baby research on morality is collaborative with her. And then the second thing is we had two babies of our own quite a while ago, and having a baby in the house and staring at a baby, it just got me fascinated with the question of what was going on in their heads.
Are the babies of psychologists more probed and, you know, dissected than any other babies in history?
Oh, our kids were laboratory rats. They were just constantly running studies with them, piloting them. They're teenagers now, and I think they forgive us. But boy, we really used them.
Well, if your teenagers forgive you, you must have done something right. Now, in our opening, Ken kind of staked out this position that kids have to learn to be moral, and that it takes a lot of socialization to turn a self-centered, amoral kid into a somewhat moral adult. But the title of your book, Just Babies, which is a bit of a pun, but I think it reflects your view. There is some kind of sense of justice or fairness with babies. So is Ken's position wrong?
Ken's not entirely wrong. There's a lot that goes on with mature adults that you'd never see in a baby. An understanding of the wrongness of slavery or sexism or racism, self-control, a self-conscious moral attitude. Those are unique to mature creatures. Babies don't have that. But I would agree with you, John, that the morality of babies starts human morality is present at the very start. We have moral emotions like empathy and compassion. We have capacity to tell right from wrong. And we even have a rudimentary sense of fairness and justice.
So you kind of, so people have this nature-nurture divide. You kind of like it's a both and rather than one or the other. Is that the right way to get your view?
I think it is. I think anybody who wanted to argue morality was entirely innate. It's a crazy view. I mean, plainly, you and I, everybody here thinks that slavery is wrong, but that's a cultural discovery. You know, there's a lot of things about morality that we have to learn, we have to develop, we have to discover, I think. But the nativism, in my view, is very strong. I think that contrary to what's been believed through much of history, the moral foundations are there from the very start.
Is it not just, really quick question, though. Could you think capacity for morality versus, like, you know, innate moral principles, maybe we have a capacity to develop into moral beings because we have these sentiments and these tendencies, but it's not yet morality. It's just kind of precursors. Would you accept that as a characterization or would you reject that?
Well, there's kind of a boring semantic argument about what you'd call morality. When do you call it morality? There's certain ways in which kids are deficient. But there's certain ways in which, say, a one-year-old has everything you would call morality. They're capable of altruistic actions. They find it painful to see someone else suffer. They like to see the good rewarded and the bad punished. They're sensitive to violations of fairness. They're capable of impartial judgments that they aren't involved in. All of these are the sorts of things that philosophers have pointed out historically are sort of hallmarks of morality.
Yeah, you're right. It's fascinating stuff. We'll have to dig into it more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about babies and morality with psychologist Paul Bloom, author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil.
Are babies inherently moral, or is morality totally learned? Is there a universal morality that's the same for all biologically normal babies? Or does even the morality of infants vary from culture to culture?
The morality of infants. The same for everyone everywhere? When Philosophy Talk continues.
Is a human baby born with a sense of morality, or is it just a wild child? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking about babies and the birth of morality. Are we all born moral? Are we all born with the same moral instincts, or does morality have to be learned? And does it vary from culture to culture? We're live on the air right here, right now. Please join this conversation. Give us your moral insights. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at comment@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Paul Bloom from Yale University. He's the author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Now, you can join Paul for a live chat at our online community of thinkers this coming Friday, September 19th, 12 noon Pacific time. Be a part of the online chat at philosophytalk.org.
Paul, I know psychologists have done all sorts of experiments. You describe lots and lots of them in your very fine, very readable book. These experiments probe the morality of babies. Now, we couldn't possibly review them all. I mean, again, get the book. It's a great book. It's a really good read. So tell us, let's start with the single most revealing experiment that's been done on this subject, the killer app of baby morality studies.
I think the killer app involves studies that we did at Yale where we show babies basically one-act plays where you have a character and somebody is nice to the character and someone else is mean to the character. We use that, you know, helping him up a hill or pushing him down, stealing a ball versus giving a ball back, helping open a box versus slamming the ball shut. We have many of these. And the core finding we get over and over again is babies prefer the nice guy over the mean guy. They want to, when they get a bit older, they want to reward the good guy and punish the bad guy. Babies at 3 months of age, and I was startled that we found this, also prefer the good guy over the bad guy, though they don't reach, they look. And then, and I think this is the cool thing, they not only prefer the good guy over the bad guy, they prefer other characters who reward the good guy, and they prefer other characters who punish the bad guy.
Okay.
So Paul, David Hume, my favorite philosopher, talked a bit about an inborn sense of sympathy. I think he called it a thin reed that needs a lot of education and reinforcement, that probably not his term, to develop into a real sense of morality. But he thought that this sympathy was the key thing. Is sympathy the emotion you would pick as to what these babies are feeling, or is Hume the philosopher you would pick as the inspiration for your view?
So there's a lot of Hume fans out there. I'm an Adam Smith man. Smith was Hume's contemporary, and I think Smith's theory of moral sentiments got morality right, and actually got innate morality right. And both Smith and Hume talk a lot about sympathy, a lot about this natural affinity towards others, the propensity to put ourselves in other people's shoes. And I think that that's an impetus towards moral behavior and moral action. But what I also want to underscore is something that Francis Hutcheson, who was Smith's advisor, actually talked about, which is a moral sense. And a moral sense isn't a propensity to do right or to avoid doing wrong. A moral sense is a capacity for judgment, like a perceptual sense. And in our research at Yale with Karen Wynn and others, we find that babies have this moral sense. They're able to judge right and wrong. So, and I think that this capacity for judgment is critical.
So this is go back to the set of experiments you... Because it went kind of quickly, but I just want to slow down because there seemed like two things going on. Just want to see if I got this right. So the babies, you said as young as 3 months, right?
Because
that's indicated by what they'll look at, right?
I know, exactly.
Okay. As young as 3 months, but progressively older, they prefer the nice guy, the nice character to the naughty character. But there's also something else. That's one thing. Right. But that doesn't convince me yet. But the next thing you said, just want to emphasize the difference, because that makes it more connected to morality. They prefer others who prefer the nice guy to the mean guy. So they're kind of making kind of impersonal moral judgments or something. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's exactly right. So the preference studies we find interesting and suggestive, but you're right to be skeptical. That just shows they like one more than another. Is it a moral preference?
Right.
And it turns out that's very hard to discover. But one hallmark that it might be moral is intuitions about reward and punishment. So we find it revealing that not only do babies not like the bad guy, they avoid the bad guy, they'll punish the bad guy, but they like other individuals who also punish the bad guy. And that suggests that they have a notion of just desserts.
Right. This is a point made by John's favorite philosopher, Hume. It might have been made by Smith, too, but I'm no Smith scholar. And Peter, more contemporary philosopher, Peter Strawson, makes a similar point. He says, look, there's the language of I don't like you, right, which is about me and my relationship to you. But moral language is more than I don't like you. Moral language says I don't like you and nobody should like you. I don't like you and I call on the world to condemn you. And so you think babies have some of that? It's like it's not just that I don't like you, but you are not to be liked.
I do. I think that these punishment studies where they get intuitions about those who reward and punish other characters are designed to tap exactly that. So designed to, they suggest that what we see in babies isn't just a sort of selfish preference. I want to avoid you and I want to hang out with you. But rather an appreciation that what somebody does is perhaps objectively right and objectively wrong. And everyone should like this person and dislike that person.
So in simple-minded history of ethics, which is about as deep as I get, the big characters are Hume and Kant. And Kant thinks ethics is basically a matter of reason. I like to say that Kant's ideal moral agent is a psychopath with no moral feelings whatsoever who nevertheless has convinced himself through reason in the categorical imperative. That's probably completely unfair. But do you see the Kantian side as having some truth to it? And how would you connect the moral lives of babes and the moral lives of Kantian reasoners?
So I'm a huge fan of Kant, and the book I'm writing now is tentatively titled Against Empathy, where I argue that when it comes to adults, emotion is a poor guide, reason is a much better guide. But the developmental story I would tell is we start off Humean and then we become Kantian. I don't think babies are capable of the sort of abstract reasoning that Kant discussed or that somebody like Rawls or Singer talks about. Rather, what babies have is these gut feelings. And this is enough. This gets morality off the ground. And then the mature accomplishment that you and I have is the capacity for abstract reasoning.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about babies and the birth of morality. Susan from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Susan.
Thank you.
What's your comment or question?
So I'm sure that you're aware of these studies, but and I don't have them to hand, but I just wanted to point out that the idea that babies, people, are born with an innate sense of fairness is borne out by studies that show that apes or chimpanzees and dogs also have an innate sense of fairness.
So, that's an interesting observation, Susan, and let's turn this to Paul. So, okay, apes and dogs and chimpanzees are social animals. They have kind of social coordination that's a little bit like morality. Is baby morality just a kind of more sophisticated version of that?
In some sense, I mean, in some way, the argument I'm making about babies parallels the argument that people like Franz de Waal make about the great apes, which is they have moral sentiments and that the gap between them and mature humans isn't as big as many think it is. On the other hand, I think that the ape and dog research, as well as the baby research, suggests that the understanding of fairness that we start off with is very limited. So what we have, what we find in apes and dogs and babies, is an exquisite sensitivity for when we get the short end of the stick. For when an individual is being treated unfairly, we respond immediately. But what you don't find in any of these subjects, including our babies, is a sense of when you get too much. Huh. So as an adult, I could recognize, hey, I got 10, you got 5. That's not very fair. But a kid will never recognize that.
Ah, I see.
The kid will recognize, I got 5, you got 10. That's not very
exactly
fair. Right.
Exactly.
I see.
And so will a capuchin monkey, and so will a dog.
So Ayn Randism is kind of like an arrested stage of moral development. Leaving that remark aside, so I just have kind of an off-the-wall question since I've got a psychologist on the phone. For various reasons, I've been looking into the mirror test lately. You know, Gordon Gallup and a lot of other people shown that chimpanzees and an assortment of other animals can, in some sense, recognize themselves in a mirror and use the information they get about the thing in the mirror to guide their own behavior, whereas a lot of other animals, chickens, for example, don't seem to be able to do that. Is there a correlation between this sense of morality and this sense of self, or has anybody looked into that?
People have looked into that, and the data is unclear. So the mirror test definitely taps something very interesting, but it's not entirely clear what it is and what it has to do with morality. To pass the mirror test, you have to have a sense of your own body and an appreciation that what you're seeing corresponds to your own body, and that's pretty sophisticated. But I'm actually skeptical it has that much to do with social understanding, morality, or even a sense of self in any interesting sense.
But you might think that morality, anything like morality, arises when, you know, you can recognize yourself as oneself among others. Mm. And I think that's what John might have been getting at, right? So to the extent that creatures can say, oh, I'm oneself, there's another self, and then there's like, what do I owe, what do I get? Then that's where kind of morality is born. I mean, would you think that makes kind of biological, psychological sense?
Well, it makes a lot of sense. Morality rests in the sense of self in at least two ways. One way is what you're talking about, which is you have to understand that you're one individual separate from others. You have to understand the distinction. If you blur them together, you don't get morality off the ground. Morality also rests in the sense of self in that many moral attitudes and moral emotions make reference to yourself, like guilt or shame or pride or gratitude. I think those are incoherent unless you have a notion that you are an individual separate from other individuals.
So let me ask you one, it's not quite off the wall, but it's a little bit abstract. I have lots of philosophy friends who are, I'll use the term for them, anti-naturalistic. They don't think things like morality or norms could reduce to anything psychological or evolved or evolutionary, because all we get out of nature is habits. We don't get the oughts out of nature, right? And morality isn't just about how people behave, it's about how they ought to behave. What do you, as a psychologist who digs around in the plumbing of the mind, think about that kind of thing? That you're never going to tell us anything about what we ought to do, Paul. You're just going to tell us about inborn psychological capacities and dispositions and habits which are different from the norms of morality.
So there's a sense in which that's obviously true. I mean, all I'm going to tell you is what comes natural to us. I'm not going to tell you what's right. And in fact, there's a lot of cases where things that come natural, upon contemplation, we realize plainly are not right. You know, so I think it comes natural to break the world up into us versus them, to be parochial, to be biased, and to some extent to be racist. But as sophisticated creatures, we can say, hey, we shouldn't do that, regardless of how natural it is. So yeah, I totally reject any simple equation from inborn to right. At the same time, though, I do think the sort of moral psychology research done by scholars like Jonathan Haidt and Josh Green and others actually do have some normative consequences. They do tell us a little bit about what's right and wrong, in part because they could tell us what intuitions we could rely on and what we can't.
We've got some more callers on the line. Joey and Marin's on the line. Welcome to the Philosophy Talk, Joey.
Okay. I'm a nanny in Marin, and, you know, I see a lot. I think that 80% of morality comes from parents. There's a karmic thing that I see that kids, there's just sometimes they come into the world either very saintly or really messed up. And it doesn't matter how great the parents are, but it seems to be a learned behavior. And a good example is my son and I, who's now 32, we're at a park and the ducks and geese were just laying around really mellow, and these kids got sticks and were, you know, trying to hurt them and chase them. And we're telling the kids, don't do that. We're all here to try to enjoy the ducks and the geese. And the mom starts yelling at us for yelling at her kids. And, you know, like, don't talk to my kids like that. And, you know, she should have been saying, don't hurt the ducks and the geese. So in my experience, it's mostly a learned behavior from what you grow up with.
Joey, thanks for the observation. Paul, I think many people believe what Joey believes. When I told my wife what we were doing this show on and the upshot of your research, she said, I don't believe it. Kids are just little animals. They're just little self-centered. Babies are just self-centered little animals. What's the one thing you could say to people like my wife or Joey to for them to pay attention to help convince them that babies are much more complicated than that?
Well, you could recognize there's two parts of the story. And there's the part that's universal, and that's what I study for a living. But then there's ways in which people differ. And you wouldn't, you know, they're Joey and your wife are entirely right to point out there's differences. Differences depending on what culture you're raised in. Differences that are influenced by your parenting. Differences that are affected. I wouldn't call it karma. I'd call it genes that you're born with. Some kids are more aggressive. Some kids are more empathetic. Some are more contemplative. And there's some heritability for all of that. But at the same time, if you look at babies, but if you also look cross-culturally across all the cultures of the world, you'll find some aspects of morality show up wherever you look. And I think to some extent we should think of morality as many linguists think of language, where English and French and Russian are very different from one another, but they have deep similarities, and there's good reason to believe that humans are predisposed to learn them and understand them.
So, Paul, let me give you a possible model that probably isn't very good, but maybe the differences will be illuminating. Take mathematics. Now, I haven't done any research on this, but pretty small children know the difference between bigger units of stuff and smaller units of stuff, like bigger pieces of cake and smaller pieces of cake. And counting comes fairly early. So whether innate or not, that's certainly a preborn disposition to deal with the world in some ways that reflects facts about numbers and geometrical facts is pretty basic. But to get from there, not just to large cardinal theory, but to adding and subtracting and dividing, that's quite a step, and you'd never try to explain why adding, subtracting, dividing works in terms of the basic instincts of children. Is that kind of similar to the situation with morality?
I would go with your analogy, but I take a bit of a different moral from it. I love the analogy with number. So one of the great discoveries of the last 20 years, some actually done by my wife Karen Wynn, is that even babies can add and subtract small numbers. They know 1 plus 1 equals 2. They know 3 minus 2 equals 1. And so can chimps and so can dogs. And so you have a rudimentary understanding of the small numbers. But then we look now at mathematics and we talk about zero and negative numbers and irrational numbers. And I think those are genuine discoveries of that are not wired in. But we wouldn't possess them if we didn't have a number sense to start with. So similarly, I think with regard to morality, we have this natural affinity to people around us, this empathy, compassion, judgment. But then we have moral notions like we should be kind to strangers in faraway lands. And for me, that's the equivalent of understanding the number zero.
You're listening.
It doesn't come easy for us.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about babies and morality with Paul Bloom, author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil.
In our final segment, we're going to examine the relationship between adult morality and infant morality. Are adult morals just a grown-up version of kids' morals, or are they fundamentally different?
Infant morality grows up when Philosophy Talk continues.
Is it true that we're all just born this way? Is morality innate? We're thinking about the moral lives of babes. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. That would be the moral lives of babies. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Paul Bloom from Yale University, author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Now, Paul will be part of a live chat at our online community of thinkers this coming Friday, September 19th at 12 noon. Pacific time. I hope you can join us. It's at philosophytalk.org. So, Paul, we've got a caller on the line, Judy from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Judy.
Hi, thank you. Listen, I'm really interested in whether or not there have been any longitudinal studies of babies who do not develop morality and become sociopaths, and whether or not these markers can be seen early on.
Wow, good question. What's the answer there, Paul? Thanks, Judy.
It is a good question. We have done longitudinal studies, and we find that some trends that you see in babies persist through toddlerhood and later on in life. But one finding from our lab and from other labs is I think the claims that there exist bad seeds, babies who are just bad from the very start, are exaggerated and overblown. There are individual differences in morality, in every aspect of morality. But at the same time, there's no such thing as an unredeemable baby. I mean, even if a baby is more aggressive or less empathetic, the behaviors and attitudes could be channeled so that the baby could grow up to be a perfectly normal kid later on.
But we've had Simon Bar-Cohen, I think that's on our show, talking about empathy and all these empathy circuits. And it seems like there's a lot of fragile wiring in the human brain, that these circuits can be broken in lots of ways. He thinks evil comes from broken empathy circuits. I don't know how prevalent that is, but do you think there's some truth to that?
Baron Cohen's a great scholar about when it comes to autism, but he's just wrong about empathy. I mean, it's kind of an urban legend that empathy plays this huge role. But if you look at studies that measure how empathetic people are, even using Baron Cohen's own measures, the correlation with that and moral behavior or immoral behavior is about zero. It turns out that how empathetic you are has very little connection with what kind of person you grew up to be. I think the problem with psychopaths and evil people has more to do with aggression and lack of self-control than it does with empathy.
So Paul, one way modern psychologists, I don't know to what extent this is part of what you spend a lot of time thinking about, but try to understand what's going on by seeing how it could have evolved. So do you have a picture of what the basic trait is, if it's not empathy, and why it evolved, why it was selected for?
It's a complicated story, and it's one that people like Darwin himself wrestled with. How could morality come about through the sort of amoral forces of natural selection? And I think there's not one story, but many stories. So I think part of it has to do with relationships with parents and kids. I think that's the sort of wellspring of caring and affection. It's surviving in small groups. It's interacting in teams where working together and caring with the other person leads to mutual benefit. I think morality is going to turn out to be not just one thing, but many things, emotional and analyses of fairness and justice, and they'll each have their own evolutionary story.
I want to build on that by going back to something you've mentioned in passing and plays a pretty major role in your book, I think is really important, the limits of morality. You know, babies, you know, some of these studies show babies have caring behavior, helping behavior, a degree of altruism, but you say it's tragically limited. I suspect that it's tragically limited for the kind of reasons that human moral community is fragile and breakable. But I wonder, tell us about the tragic limits of infant morality and how that relates to the limits of adult morality, frankly.
By nature, we care a lot about those around us, and we are indifferent to those far away. Indifferent at best. We often wish that they would suffer. We are very, very naturally associate ourselves with people in an in-group, family and friends, and we are morally indifferent to people in the out-group. One of the great accomplishments then, and one of the things we have to do as societies and parents and teachers, is to modify that. It's as if we have to teach somebody about negative numbers and zero. It's difficult, it's unnatural, but the moral equivalent is we have to come to the realization through reason, through a sort of Kantian method, that the lives of strangers are as valuable to them as the lives of our friends are to themselves, and to expand the moral circle.
So Paul, I have a question about gender or sex differences on these issues. If you look at other animals, at least the ones I'm most familiar with, male goats and female goats are a lot different. Female goats, towards their own babies exhibit things that are clearly connected with human behaviors of caring and nurturing and so forth and so on. Male goats, you put them over in another pasture, keep them out of everybody's way, and they mostly just pee on themselves. You'd think there would be a very basic, evolutionarily different story for the male and the female of the species. Does that hold true with humans? Do you see difference between male and female babies in terms of these innate behaviors?
It holds true with regard to certain moral behaviors. Statistically, girls are more likely, are more empathetic, more compassionate, less aggressive, more likely to help, more likely to soothe. It's not a huge difference, but it's a reliable difference, and it persists through adulthood. When it comes to moral judgments and moral understandings, though, there appears to be no difference. People have looked for a long time, and there were all sorts of ideological assumptions that there should be a difference. Women should be more focused on ethic of caring and men on ethic of autonomy, mm-hmm. and it hasn't panned out.
Carol Gilligan a while ago argued for this kind of view, and I don't think there's much, tell me if I'm wrong, I'm an outsider there, I don't think there's much support in the whole range of developmental psychology for those views anymore. Is that right or wrong?
You're right. I like Gilligan's work because I think she elegantly captures two ways of thinking about morality, but she's mistaken in assuming that one's male, one's female. The data just hasn't turned out that way.
So I want to go back to the tragic limits, though, and what you said about Kant. I mean, you said, that sounds very much like a Kantian philosopher talking. There is a moral truth out there. We have to somehow work toward it. But it makes me think, actually, like the Enlightenment view of human beings as such, being the center of rights and all that stuff, is, you know, a kind of late cultural achievement. It may be a correct cultural achievement, but it's very much a late cultural achievement, not a natural outgrowth of the moral sense or anything like that. You know, so I think it's much more contingent. This kind of universal cosmopolitan morality that I love is much more, is not as deeply rooted in human psychology as we might like to believe.
So there's two claims there, and they're both interesting. One is, I agree with you, it is late. I view it as analogous to certain mathematical discoveries or scientific discoveries. They take a long time to emerge, and they would only emerge under certain conditions. As for contingent, it's an interesting question. So people like Peter Singer have argued that once you're smart enough, you could use the sort of escalator of reason to take you up to places that you wouldn't have otherwise expected, and that given enough time, you will get there. So I think someone like Singer would suggest that any creature with an innate predisposition like us, over time, will come to adopt a universal morality.
That's a big claim, and it's a provocative claim, and I'm not sure how we could settle that claim, but it is a big and provocative and interesting claim. It's almost Hegelian in its scope as ambitions. But I want to ask you, as a developmental psychologist, is the kid born today, I don't know, you're not a historical anthropologist, is the kid born today any morally different than, you know, the caveman kid? If this is true, what you say, then the gap between the initial endowment and what the culture is going to impose on us gets larger and larger. You know what I mean?
Much larger and larger. And this is true for everything. It's true for morality, but it's true for math as well. And it's true for science. And it's true for other sorts of social interactions. And so there's more and more to learn. But I'm quite confident that that's so. I mean, historically, our morality, I'm a moral realist, so I'm very comfortable saying that it's better now than it was 5,000 years ago. But at the very least, it's different, and it departs more from our natural proclivities.
So you might be a moral realist, but you're also, one of the things that struck me in reading your book is I invented a term. People debate about moral relativism, and every sort of high school senior and college freshman is kind of a reflex moral relativist.
Oh, yes.
And people say, that's wrong. But here is a thing that I think your work helps us to see. There is a certain moral plasticity, right? Because cultures warp this thing that we call morality in all kinds of different shapes. And that is an inescapable fact, that there is this kind of moral plasticity.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think that I'm impressed by moral universals, but it'd be mad to deny the very interesting moral differences, and these differences can only be explained by differences imposed upon by our cultures.
So how do you reconcile your moral realism with that acknowledgement of this rampant moral plasticity?
Well,
that's what the last thought.
I treat moral plasticity like scientific plasticity. Different cultures have different views about the stars and about the origin of the universe, and some are right and some are wrong.
Right.
So as a moral realist, I'll say some cultures get it wrong.
Well, that's on that thought. I want to have you back when you finish your book on the limits of empathy, because I read your article on that. It's really fascinating. But I have to thank you for joining us now.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a lot of fun.
Our guest has been Paul Bloom. He's a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University. He's author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. So, John, just what are you thinking now about justice and babies?
Well, I wasn't thinking about justice and babies. I was thinking about psychology back when I was a graduate student in the 60s and how philosophically barren it seemed to be. I mean, you had Skinnerians and behaviorists with these really radical ideas, but they didn't seem to help much. And then on Philosophy Talk, we've had such a parade of interesting, commonsensical, easy to talk to, philosophically sophisticated psychologists. So has psychology changed, or am I just older and wiser?
No, psychology has changed. Philosophy has changed. We're coming closer and closer together. At Yale, they're about to start a new joint PhD program in philosophy and psychology. If I was a young person, that's what I would do today. But I have to say that our conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And you can go to that website and join us at the community this coming Friday, September 19th at 12 noon Pacific. And then you can chat online with today's guest, Paul Bloom, some of you who had questions we couldn't get to. You can ask them then. Now, the man who gives birth to speed, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we sadly place yesterday's smartphone on the trash heap of history, even as we engage with today's slightly improved smartphone. We lurch by increments into the ultra-modern world of tomorrow, but the past keeps weighing us down, our attitudes towards children, for instance. There are different attitudes towards the influx of children trying to get into the U.S. over our southern border. Some believe they are helpless victims of horrible living conditions in the countries from which they fled. That makes sense to me. But then I think if we welcome them, will these children be grateful orphans and grow up to become willing cannon fodder in our underfunded foreign wars? Or will they be ungrateful and still grow up to become cannon fodder because those are the only jobs left? I'm torn. Others believe these children are part of a liberal plot. If we let them in, they'll grow up to be Democrats. And we'll all be forced to learn Spanish and drink fluoridated water. Our concern for children is pretty recent, historically. We didn't care about children for centuries, only for what they might grow up to be. If we were poor, we'd put our children in swaddling clothes until they were old enough to shove up the chimney to get the soot out, or put them on the street to beg for enough money to buy us gin. If we were rich, we'd birth the child, try to repress the whole experience, and put the offspring into the nursery with a disturbed nanny until they're old enough to ship off to boarding school. Capitalism changed all that. We became aware of poverty and became conspicuous in our flaunting of our lack of it. If formerly the only children in literature were in fairy tales or murder victims in Macbeth, suddenly we had Oliver Twist and David Copperfield, Pip and Alice, Huck and Tom, Little Women, Little House. We let our own children run wild, at least in our mythical past, in a vast neighborhood of bikes, stickball games, cowboys, pirates, and swimming holes. Then somewhere in there, parents started to get worried, and teachers. We got helicopter parents, nonstop testing, constant monitoring, play dates. We feared for the kids, and we became in fear of them. Babies and children in popular culture are often shown as downright evil. Rhoda and the bad seed was bad on her bones. Was that psychology that made her evil? Genetics. Jack and Lord of the Flies made evil by circumstance, or was the evil just waiting for circumstance to reveal itself? Sometimes children are evil because, you know, Satan, like Rosemary's Baby or the baby that becomes Damien in The Omen. There's a creepy evil girl with the stringy black hair crawling out of televisions in The Ring. The zombie baby in the remake of Dawn of the Dead. The vampire little girl in Interview with the Vampire. And the vampire little boy in Near Dark. A girl can be possessed, as in The Exorcist. A girl can be spoiled into evil, like Mildred Pierce's daughter. You can be reanimated, like a little boy with a scalpel in Pet Sematary. Or you can all be the kids that aren't Charlie Bucket in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. Let us not forget Anthony from the famous Twilight Zone episode, It's a Good Life. The actor, Billy Mumy, went on to become a beloved child actor in Lost in Space, palling around with a robot and a cranky scientist. But as Anthony, he was a child with superhuman powers who could destroy anybody if he didn't do as he pleased, using only his mind. He would think them into the cornfield, which became a cultural trope, as did the robot's catchphrase on Lost in Space, Danger, Will Robinson. Maybe that's what we need at our nation's border. Nanny robots, or failing that, fewer cornfields. Once those kids start thinking, who knows where they'll think us. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Hey, Stewie, how about Daddy teaches you how to swim?
Go away, fat man.